Who is in charge? In our examination of the Nuremberg trials, we are naturally interested in who supervised the NMT proceedings. Pro forma, Taylor supervised almost everything except the appointments of the judges, since the chief of counsel's formal responsibilities were not confined to the mere prosecution of cases. His office was also charged with determining who should and who should not be tried. There was no separate proceeding for formulating indictments, such as a grand jury, what the former were to be charged with, and how the latter were to be disposed of. The office also took over the functions of the Nuremberg staff, and hence one may assume that the office took over, at least formally, the expanded Nuremberg staff itself. Thus, the office was responsible for interrogations, field work, examination of documents, court reporting, and translating and interpreting. We have given reasons why one should expect that this Nuremberg staff had been under the effective supervision of the War Crimes Branch, and it will shortly be seen that, whatever Taylor's formal powers, his actual functions do not suggest that he ever took over the Nuremberg staff in any effective sense. The War Crimes Branch, although quartered in far-off Washington, continues to be involved in our consideration of the Nuremberg trials. On June 12, 1948, the American press carried a story which reported that an officer of the U.S. Army, Colonel David Mickey Marcus, a West Point graduate operating under the alias Mickey Stone, had been killed in action while serving as Supreme Commander of the Jewish Forces in the Jerusalem Sector in the Arab-Jewish War for the control of Palestine. Actually, Marcus had been erroneously shot by one of his own sentries. The New York Times summarized his career. He had been Commissioner of Corrections in New York before the war and, as an Army officer, had helped draft the German and Italian surrender terms. He was a legal aide at the Potsdam Conference, summer of 1945, after which point, if one judges for the adulatory New York Times article only, his career ended, since we are told of no other activity of Marcus, until he turns up with the Haganah in Palestine in January 1948, visits the U.S. in April, receiving a medal at a ceremony in the British Embassy in Washington, probably a cover for negotiations on the details of the final British capitulation, and then returns to Palestine after 3 weeks to take over in Jerusalem. The only hint we get of any activity in the period August 1945 to January 1948 is a story on June 24, page 15, reporting that the London Daily Telegraph of the same date said that, quote, he was at the time of his death a full colonel in the Judge Advocate General's Office of the Organized Reserve of Officers. Although not subject to military discipline, he had agreed to remain subject to recall, unquote. Marcus had, in fact, been Weir's successor as head of the War Crimes Branch. Immediately after the war, he had been, quote, number three man in making American policy, unquote, in occupied Germany, but was taken out of this position early in 1946 in order to take the war crimes job. His appointment was effective as of February 18, 1946, but he spent a few months in Japan after leaving Germany, and then moved into the Washington office of the War Crimes Branch until April 1947, when he retired from the Army and went into private law practice. Our previous observations obviously suggest that it was in reality the War Crimes Branch that exercised the crucial functions in respect to the NMT. This is the case, as is made clear by a careful reading of Taylor's official final report on the NMT trials, although the fact is not emphasized there. The fact is confirmed by the remarkable book by Josiah E. Dubois, who headed the I.G. Farben NMT prosecution, and Berkman's book about Marcus provides some sketchy information on this aspect of Marcus's career. Marcus was made head of the War Crimes Branch primarily in order, quote, to take over the mammoth task of selecting hundreds of judges, prosecutors and lawyers, unquote, for the NMT and Far East, Tokyo trials.
In December 1946, Dubois had been summoned to Marcus's office in Washington to discuss the possibility of Dubois taking over the prosecution of leading officials of the great German chemicals firm, I.G. Farben.
Dubois had been undecided, so he conferred at length with Marcus on the problems involved, one of the problems being whether or not there was sufficient evidence to charge Farben with an aggressive war plot and, if so charged, the possible political repercussions that might ensue. They discussed the general advantages of bringing the Farben men to trial. One point Marcus made was that a trial might show how Farben managed to develop certain weapons in total secrecy. Then too, if they went free, they might start working for the Russians. Marcus displayed great knowledge of Farben. He pointed out that there was a warehouse full of Farben records in nearby Alexandria, Virginia, a fact that Dubois forgot, until later events forced him to recall and act on it during the pretrial investigation. They got around to the required length of the pretrial investigation. Marcus said, quote, as far as I'm concerned, you could go over there for as long or as short a time as you liked, unquote. Dubois suggested that he would need about 4 months, and Marcus replied, quote, I have no objection to that. Within a few days after you get home, you should get a wire from Telford Taylor agreeing to it, unquote. Taylor, of course, was in Europe in his capacity of chief of counsel. Dubois records Taylor's activities relative to the Farben trial. He responded favorably to a staff member's suggestion that Dubois, under whom the staff member had worked in the Treasury Department during the war, be appointed to prosecute Farben. He passed the recommendation on to Washington. After Dubois had taken the job, he had plans to see Taylor to get his okay for adding another man, specified by Dubois, to the prosecution staff. The okay was granted. Taylor went to Paris to plead before the French cabinet for the extradition of a key Farben man. Taylor gave the opening speech at the Farben trial and then disappeared from the proceedings. Taylor was not involved in the pre-trial investigation or in the formulation of the specific charges made by the prosecution. All of this suggests rather strongly that Taylor's role was in public relations and that he was not deeply involved in the details of the running of the trials, which were his formal responsibility. Such situations are not unusual in large-scale operations. The facts show that the real organizers of the NMT trials were not as much in the public eye as Taylor was. In effect and possibly in intention, Taylor was a front man. Marcus, as head of the War Crimes Branch, no doubt exercised effective control of much of the Nuremberg staff, and he selected the judges and lawyers for the trials, with only a handful of exceptions. The book by Dubois shows that Taylor was not involved with the trials on the working level, so the inescapable conclusion is that the substantial powers of Taylor's office were actually exercised either by the War Crimes Branch or by persons subordinate to Taylor. In examining the prominent persons in the latter group, one encounters Robert M. W. Kempner, who is discussed in Chapter 5. Marcus seems to have had a real importance quite incommensurate with his relatively common rank of colonel, because we are told that during the war he had made a, quote, favorable impression on FDR. He was one of the anonymous handful who charted American policy behind the scenes, unquote. A man whose career was remarkably intertwined with that of Marcus was General J. H. Hildring, who headed the Army Civil Affairs Division, CAD, to which Marcus was assigned in 1943. The CAD had been created in 1943 within the Army General Staff, in anticipation of a need for a group to concern itself with policies to be followed in occupied territories. It had been thought that Fiorello LaGuardia was to head the CAD, but the job went to Hildring. Marcus became a member and later the chief of the planning branch of the CAD. It was as a consequence of Marcus's activities in the CAD that he made his mark. His assignment to the military government of Germany was a direct result of his CAD responsibilities. It was Hildring who, several months later, pulled him out of his military government position and assigned him to head the War Crimes Branch, which was transferred from the JAG to the CAD on March 4, 1946. Then Hildring immediately moved over to the State Department as an Assistant Secretary of State, in charge of occupied areas problems. In this capacity he headed a secretariat, which coordinated Army, Navy, and State Department policies in Germany. In September 1947, he left the State Department and became an advisor to the U.S. delegation at the United Nations, where the diplomatic battle between the Zionists and the Arabs was being waged. Hildring, quote, was a tower of strength from the outset. As information link with the Jewish representatives, he frequently conversed with Zionist strategists, unquote. Then, at about the time Marcus was made Supreme Commander of the Jewish Forces in Jerusalem, Hildring was appointed back to the State Department as Assistant Secretary of State for Palestine. Zionist sources have subsequently boasted that both the UN and Second State Department appointments were direct result of Zionist lobbying. Quite a pair, Marcus and Hildring. The filling of the War Crimes Branch position with a fanatical Zionist, the, quote, first soldier since biblical times to hold the rank of general in the Army of Israel, unquote, is not only significant in terms of what the Zionist might do in the position, but also significant in revealing, in a simple way, the nature of the overall political forces operating at the trials. This is the important point. It is simply not possible to imagine an appointment that would make these trials more suspect. Under these political conditions, it is simply silly to expect anything but a frame-up at the trials. The associated extermination hoax will be exposed with complete clarity in these pages.